I think that there are, as a historian, there are three ways that belief in the ideology of whiteness has done damage in relation to drugs and drug practices. The first relates to drug policy. First wave of widespread drug harm in America took place in the late 19th century. And it's important to understand why. This was a time of industrial revolution, growing consumer markets. People were using all different kinds of consumer goods, more shirts, more cars, more books, more candles, more forks, and more drugs, because they were more widely available for the same reason that all other goods were more widely available. With more use came more of the harms associated with drug use. And as those harms expanded dramatically, social authorities said, we have a problem, we want to respond to this problem. But they responded to the problem in two different ways because they saw two different kinds of problems, these mostly white authorities. They saw white, native-born, middle-class men, and especially women, buying their drugs through the medical system with the advice of a doctor from a pharmacist. And they saw these people as innocent victims. If they experienced drug harm, such as addiction, they saw them as innocent victims of broad social forces beyond their control. So an out-of-control drug industry, ignorant, poorly educated doctors, or the stresses of living in a time of rapid economic change. So they responded to these drug victims with consumer protections. They regulated the drug industry, they regulated medical practice, and they created mechanisms to allow continued provision of drugs to people who had become addicted through the medical system over the next half century. Meanwhile, working class immigrant and non-whites, mostly men in cities, who had less access to the medical system and tended to be purchasing their drugs in a different way, still legal. There were no anti-drug laws this time, still legal. They saw this group of people as willful deviants who were criminals because of their innate racial capacities, because their innate character flaws. And so they passed the law you heard of before, the Harrison Anti-Narcotic Act in 1914, to outlaw them and arrest them. By the mid-1920s, drug violators were 30% of America's federal prisoners. That's 100 years, almost 100 years ago. So when you look at this first response, you see these white middle classes in the medical system got a response that bears some elements of what we call harm reduction. You got regulated availability with a focus on the safety of end consumers, and you had drug maintenance for people who had become addicted. How well did this work? Well, slowly over about half a century, drug harms related to medical provision of opioids and cocaine, it went down. It did work slowly to reduce the harm associated with drug use in that context. But these other populations, these immigrants, non-whites, their numbers, the numbers of drug harm related to their use did not go down. Just punishing them and locking them up, big surprise, was not effective. So the first harm of whiteness, I would say, is that it helped prevent good policy from being applied widely, because they looked at this policy, looked at its success, and said, well, that success is due to the qualities of the white people that we gave it to. It's not a success based on the policy itself. That was something special about white people that made that policy work for them. So that's the first harm. The second harm has to do with drug harms and especially addiction. These policies that were oriented towards white drug users, they helped them, but they also hid them. When people studied drug problems in the 1920s, they thought a lot of the white drug users had disappeared because they weren't showing up in jails, they weren't showing up in hospitals, because they were being taken care of in a different way. And so addiction came to be ever more closely associated with these urban populations, sometimes called the dangerous classes by these reformers and authorities. So what this meant is that the ability to see and recognize drug harms among those white middle class populations was reduced. And when drug companies and physicians came up with new drugs to replace the ones that had been so tightly regulated, talking about barbiturate sedatives and amphetamine stimulants, these were very lightly regulated because they were being used in the medical system where addiction had supposedly disappeared. Those white people didn't want to be addicted, so they were making good decisions, right? So unsurprisingly, these drugs became massively widely used in America starting in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s. The overwhelming majority of people who were using psychoactive drugs in America during these decades were white middle class people using barbiturates and amphetamines. These drugs have risks associated with them, And a very large and significant problems with drug dependence and drug overdose were associated with these drugs. Just to give a quick example, 1953, the overdose rate for barbiturates was nearly 8 per 100,000. To give a point of comparison, in 2013, the overdose rate for prescription opioids was almost 5 per 100,000. So this was a genuine public health crisis taking place right in the teeth of a supposed drug war with drugs that were being widely advertised everywhere you looked and widely used. So this is a second harm of whiteness in this story. It made the risks of so-called white drugs, if you're a drug company and you can have your drug be considered white, it makes it that much harder to have it be regulated with the consumer protections that can limit the kind of harms and risks that can come along with widespread use. So that's the second harm. Third and last harm relates to drug benefits, not drug harms, but drug benefits. Once you add in pharmaceuticals, sedatives, stimulants, and narcotics to the story of drugs in American history, the idea of there being a drug war kind of recedes a little bit. And you look at a tale whose overwhelmingly dominant numbers are about the promotion and encouragement of drug use, because these drugs can produce benefits to people. Sedatives, stimulants, and narcotics are important drugs that the U.S. government has clearly, throughout this entire period, decided should be used and should be widely used. So instead, what you see, instead of a drug war, you see what might best be characterized as a segregated consumer market for drugs, just like you had a segregated consumer market for houses and movie theaters and amusement parks, etc. You have one, whites are invited to participate in a consumer market called pharmaceuticals. These are of drugs that are relatively well regulated. You know what is in them. They are provided by actors who, at least in theory, share the goal of the well-being of the end consumers in that market. And meanwhile, non-whites have less privileged access to that system and have easier access to a totally unregulated drug market, providing drugs of unknown provenance, where if they run into drug harm, instead of being taken care of as the ones in that the white half of this kind of Jim Crow drug provision system get, they are punished because they become visible. When you experience a drug harm, you become visible and you actually get punished and suffer further harm. So that's the third harm that whiteness perpetrated in the system, is that it has actually helped restrict access to the benefits of drugs. It's important to remember that there's a reason why these drugs are widely used and are the basis of, you know, one of America's biggest industries.
Great, thanks. Helena?
Thank you. So we are now in the era of the endangered white American, with the media lamenting the decline in life expectancy among white men and women, largely due to opioid overdose, right? That's the leading cause. In this one instance, racism seems to be protective of non-whites because they're less often offered opioid painkillers. But the lesser-known story behind the whiteness of opioid overdose, as well as the pharmaceuticalized government response to white overdose, is the way that whiteness has been used to relax narcotic regulations, to ethnically target less stigmatized white markets, and to biologize addiction in ways that mask the social and economic conditions surrounding drug use. So I'm going to give you a quick racial biography because Jesse gave me 5 minutes. A quick racial biography of three key opioids based on my last 10 years of research on opioids and race, something that really hit me over the head in my practice as an addiction psychiatrist and as a cultural anthropologist. The first drug is OxyContin. So it's FDA approval in 1996 as a quote-unquote minimally addictive pain reliever. It was based on a 3-month-long clinical trial among terminal cancer patients that failed to account for real-world social conditions of its use, such as the ease with which the sustained-release capsules could be crushed and injected or snorted. Purdue Pharmaceuticals then had license to hire almost 700 drug reps to canvass general doctors in largely white areas of states, like largely white suburban and rural America, including states like Maine, Kentucky, and Ohio, which led to a 10-fold increase in prescriptions for opioid pain relievers. So this aggressive marketing was possible largely because of the white identity of the anticipated opioid consumer. The second drug that I want to give a biography for is buprenorphine, otherwise known as Suboxone, and you already heard that drug mentioned this morning in the Q&A. As a maintenance treatment for opioid addiction, it has become the primary governmental response to overdose, along with naloxone overdose reversal kits. Congress specifically legalized it for private office treatment of opioid dependents in the year 2000, out of concern for the growing numbers of, quote, and here I'm quoting the congressional record, suburban youth not appropriate for methadone. So in doing so, Congress reversed 86 years of prohibition against physicians using opioids to treat opioid addiction that is outside of stigmatized methadone clinics that are DEA regulated and require daily observed dosing. Bear in mind that methadone clinics were introduced by Nixon as the first weapon in the war on drugs during the black and brown urban heroin crisis of the 1970s. And that's really why they're largely located in poor black and brown neighborhoods. So in contrast, in the 1990s, the National Institute on Drug Abuse allotted $27 million for clinical trials of Suboxone as an office-based treatment for addiction. Congress designated Suboxone an orphan drug in order to extend the patent protection for Suboxone an additional 10 years and worked with the manufacturer to develop an 8-hour certification requirement for doctors who want to prescribe Suboxone, which helped to limit Suboxone to the private and therefore largely white sector. Okay, the third drug to offer a biography for is heroin, which is now recapturing its whiteness due to a crisis of blame. Since white opioid-addicted people are not politically acceptable targets for arrest, our government's response has been directed at prescribers and at the drug itself. That is, the prescription drug monitoring programs that enforce physicians' participation with threats to their medical license in New York State, for example, and with the withdrawal of the original OxyContin from the market and its replacement by newly patented tamper-resistant formulations. As supplies of pills dried up, new white users turned to heroin. A majority of them are now women, given that women disproportionately see doctors for pain treatment. So we're now back to middle-class white women as the primary clientele for heroin. This replicates the 19th century demographic following Bayer Pharmaceuticals' introduction of heroin to the market in 1898 as a non-addictive treatment for morphine addiction, which was widespread among Victorian housewives. And this demographic, in turn, now in 2016, is inspiring bipartisan calls to enhance funding for addiction treatment and to begin to decriminalize heroin use. So what these biographies teach us is that whiteness is a powerful instrument of biocapital. It works by not naming whiteness, and I heard someone calling out when I cited the congressional record, suburban white youth. Yes, that's a code language for white. So it uses coded language, such as suburban and mainstream America. Pharma and biotech make up the single largest industry in the world, and the U.S. consumes 80% of the world's opioid supply. Bear in mind that we make up less than 5% of the world's population. Whiteness is a major driver for opening otherwise stigmatized and outlawed markets, with newly patented narcotics netting in the billions of dollars. Whiteness is an industrial strategy, a cloaking device that lures white America to pay for dangerous drugs at inflated, patented prices, but also with their lives.